Hello, everyone. I'm David Kern. Welcome to Libromania, a new podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. If you love books and all the things that make books great, this podcast is for you. Each week, I'll be presenting conversations with authors, designers, publishers, artists, biographers, critics, and scholars about the various things that make books worth celebrating. We'll be talking book design and bookstores, book printing and book collecting. We'll be talking about the lives and problems of famous authors and the science behind our love of books. We'll be chatting with working writers about their process and with scholars about the art of writing biography. Let's just say we'll be diving into a nice, lengthy adventure story with no plans to come up for air anytime soon. This is chapter one, in which I'll be chatting about the best books of 2018 with Mr. John Wilson, one of the very best book critics you'll find anywhere. The former editor of Books and Culture, which he ran for 20 plus years, Mr. Wilson currently is a contributing editor at the Englewood Review of Books and a columnist for First Things. There aren't many people who love books more than John, and there are even fewer people who are as knowledgeable about them as he is. But then again, I suppose the two go hand in hand. This conversation seemed like the ideal way to kick off a podcast for the book obsessed. It seemed only natural to talk about some of our favorite books of 2018. So here's my conversation with John Wilson. Hope you enjoy. Be prepared to take notes. You'll want to dive in right away. Thanks for joining me here on Libromania. First of all, thank you for being here. There's nothing more exciting to me than just talking about books with people who love books. So I'm really excited to chat with you.
Likewise.
Let me just start with this. How many books in a given year are you mailed to review or to just because someone wants, a little bit of John Wilson's attention?
I don't know exactly. I don't get as many as I did when I was the 20 plus years I was editing Books and Culture, but I still do see a fair number of books. And then, as Wendy would tell you, I also buy books. I buy a lot more books than I did during the time that I was doing Books and Culture. But I did have they did give me a generous allowance for book and magazines and stuff like that, in addition to what already came in. So, if you could see, if this was a video conversation instead of you would see stacks of books all around. And in fact, I'm right now trying to reduce some of those stacks because our oldest granddaughter, Teresa, is coming for a few days on Friday, and then two of our children are going to be here soon, and then the third one is coming right after. Third of the four, one of them can't make it, is coming right after Christmas. So yes, lots of books.
is it painful to have to winnow those stacks down?
It's very painful. It is. I mean, I don't have to tell you, because it's clear you're a bookish person, that any bookish person has to do some of that. Yeah. I've probably done less than many, because I love hanging on to books. You never know when you're going to want to refer to something. And then also, it often turns out, I'm sure you've had this experience, that for some reason or another, without any intent at all, I will maybe be looking for one thing and come across something else, or maybe I'll have to move something, and I come up on a book, and it's sometimes shocking. I mean, this happened to me the other day. I was dealing with Native Americans, and I remembered the book. I remember reading it when it came out, and I picked it up and saw that it was published in the year 2000. And so that was 18 years ago, but I hadn't looked at it since I first read it, and it just happened to be something that was very timely. So yes, lots of books and new ones coming in that I love getting the mail. That's one of my favorite parts of the day.
How many books do you have in your home, would you guess? Do you have any idea?
I don't, but I know it would be somewhere in the thousands, but I don't know exactly how many.
So I imagine when you move, if you have done so recently, probably the number one decision about it is, how do I move my, transport my books without harming them? And then also, is there enough space for all of these books to be accurately cataloged in my home?
We haven't moved since we moved from Southern California, from Pasadena to Wheaton in 1994.
Okay.
And the very thought of moving, is, nightmarish. So if we have to do it, obviously we'll deal with it, but
yeah,
it's something I'd prefer not to think about.
Yeah. So how many books do you read in a year then?
Well, people ask me that all the time, or variants on that. And I give pretty much the same answer, which is, it all depends on what you mean by reading. Of course, when I was doing books and culture, I was always reading partly with the thought, is this a book that we might want to cover, or is it a book that I might want to hang on to because it's on a subject that's likely to generate a good piece and maybe another book will come out to pair with it, and so on and so on. And if you do that for a long enough time, because even before I started Books and Culture, I was doing some other things involved with reference publishing, but one of the things that we published was a review of 200 books in two volumes of 200 books that had, I mean, that had come out in the previous calendar year, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty large list and included a lot of fiction and a lot of nonfiction. And so I have had my brain working like that for such a long time that even though I'm not doing a magazine now, I'm helping out with a couple of things like the Englewood Review of Books. And but I'm just in that habit that even now when I'm looking at books, I'm thinking about, oh, this would make a good review with so-and-so. And a lot of your reading is quite quick. You're just assessing something. And it's really surprising how much you can pick up about a book in just 10 minutes. I mean, that sounds totally ridiculous. I know it sounds like you barely have time to read the blurb, but of course, if it's somebody you know absolutely nothing about, that's a different matter. But most books are part of some kind of ongoing conversation that you have some familiarity with, and something that isn't conveyed very often in reviews, it's because it's hard to do, is that books, every book has a flavor, you know, and sometimes that comes out under things like style and so on, but you read just a very little of a book and you get some of the flavor of it, even though, of course, you haven't come anywhere close to assimilating the entire, argument and all the, facts deployed or all the story told, whatever that may be. But, some books then are a matter of just looking at very briefly. Then there's another level where you're not reading every single word. You're basically skimming. But if you're a practiced reader, you pretty well assimilate the argument of the book. And that's the way that I read a lot of books. And then there are books that you read from the first page to the last. And if it's a novel that I enjoy, I quite often read it again right after I finish it, you know, because the first reading is a special reading, because even if you have some idea of the author and a little, you know, a little about the book, the first reading is the only time you experience that unfolding, the full surprise. But there's a particular pleasure in, if you've enjoyed a book, in going back and rereading it right then, which is different from the kind of rereading you do when, you know, you read, let's say, I reread a lot of Agatha Christie this year. It's a different kind of rereading because you're not reading again something that you just finished reading. You're reading something you've read before, sometimes a year or two, sometimes 10 or 15 years before. It all adds up to a lot of books. I couldn't tell you how many exactly, but yeah, a lot.
How quickly can you tell whether you will like a book?
Oh, usually very soon. It's not necessarily, you're not necessarily going to know that it's just a fantastic book, though sometimes you do know that right at the start, but it's quite rare to read three or four pages, for me at least, I should say. It's quite rare for me to read three or four pages of a book and think I'm really going to like it and then find that I don't. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't, if it's a book that has an argument, it doesn't mean there won't be things you disagree with. You know, I read tons of books by people who see the world quite differently from the way I do, the way you do. And, you know, that's just part of what reading is all about. But it's quite rare for me, at least, to read something and think I'm really going to like this and then find no. But sometimes it takes longer to get a sense of how much you're going to like it or dislike it, you know.
How often are you surprised by a book in terms of, you know, maybe I assume you probably have a pretty good grasp of what your own taste is and sort of what books.
I'm surprised not infrequently in that, for instance, the book that I picked for my book of the year, the Atlas of a Lost World, it was a book that I had to read more slowly than I normally do. I don't think of myself, you know, I'm not conscious of like racing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I just know from talking to people and so on, I know that I am a fast reader, but I had to read this book more slowly, not because it wasn't interesting and not because the writer wasn't skillful. He was extremely skillful, but because of the way that within a given chapter, and each chapter is pegged to a certain period of time, like maybe 15,000 years ago, you know, or 20,000 or 10,000 years ago. And in each chapter, he switches from what you might call sort of a synthesis of the known history. So it's a historical voice. And then he might also throw in some conversation that he had with, let's say, a scholar or an expert of some kind. And then also there are bits of personal narrative where he goes on jaunts looking for traces of our ancient predecessors in North America. And that is done, I think, deliberately to give you a sense of what he's telling you all throughout the book, that the very earth we live in is just layered with this enormously long, complicated history, which we continue to try to untangle. But it's a very palpable sense of that you get in reading the book. And so that I had no idea that it was going to be that special kind of a book. And so in that sense, I was surprised and delighted. I knew I'd be interested in the general subject matter, but was only reading it that I really got the sense of what kind of book it is.
Yeah. I have your little blurb that you wrote on your best of the year article for First Things, your best of the year list. And you used words like dazzling and dreamlike. So, and this is a book, and the book that you're referring to is Atlas of the World Travels in Ice Age America by Craig Childs.
That's right. Yes.
And so what set that up? I mean, you're describing it a little bit, but what's you, as you said, you named this as your book of the year. And how is that book set apart from some of these other books that you listed in your list? I mean, to name it your book of the year.
Yeah, sure. It's certainly not. Part of the reason I call it favorite books of the year, and some years in the past, I've gone to more effort to make the point that I'm not making any claim that these are the best books, whatever that would mean, the best books of the year. Sure, I don't object to people doing
who
that.
Can
I
judge
know,
that?
You know, it's an eye-catching thing, and I look at lots of lists like that, and so it's not something that I'm particularly brooding over, but it's very subjective, and it's the books that also, it doesn't include, you know, whenever that list gets in print, I immediately start thinking of, you know, there were two books that had to do with rock music and Christians, and one by Greg,
Thornberry?
Yes, on Larry Norman, and the other, other one by Randall Stevens. And I actually have been working on a piece for ages for the Christian Century on those two books, trying to be able to say what I think is worth saying. But they're such interesting books. And so whenever the list actually appears, I always think of other books that easily could have been on it. But I make a point when I do the list of not giving myself, you know, 2 days to think about it and then throw some out and put some in, because if I did that, I would just be dithering. And in fact, this list was way too long, you know, as I mentioned in introducing it. I mean, it was really way too long, but I didn't want to get into the, as I said, a kind of a dithering process. So it was just the book that when I thought back about the books that I was reading, and it was just, it doesn't take me very long. You know, I just think about the books that I've read in the year and what comes to mind most vividly. And I'm very interested in, I mentioned that I was reading a lot of books, rereading a lot of books having to do with Native Americans. And it's something that I'm interested in since I was a kid. Hmm. So that's part of the reason this book caught my eye. But I'm also very interested in the reality of time and like the novel Sleep of Memory by Patrick Modiano,
that's what I was going to ask you about.
That it was a completely different kind of book from Craig Child's book, but they both are quite wonderful to me in getting at something of our experience of time. So for someone else, they might read Child's book. I certainly hope that at least a few people will pick it up who might not have read it and find that it's really wonderful. But, you know, for someone else, that might not be as much of an attraction, and that's fine. But I would say that it has to do with, we were talking about books have flavors. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just about whether you agree with the book or whether you're impressed with the writer's skill and intelligence and so on. It goes beyond that to something that's like a taste, you know, like a very vivid taste. That's a crucial part of it.
So if you're talking about this concept of taste when you're reading books and thinking about them as a critic, it calls to mind the concept of like a really, really good meal, which would have, you know, there'd be multiple courses and multiple layers and multiple flavors.
Yes.
Does that apply to books as well? I mean, am I taking the metaphor further than you sort of mean to, but, or would you say that a great book does have that way of melding flavors and offering multiple courses?
No, I mean, I would say it's more like, I don't want to stretch it too far, but it's not so much the book itself, though books certainly, many great books cover quite a range, and it certainly can be true that in one sense that a book doesn't just have a flavor, it has different flavors, mm-hmm. but in the sense that I'm thinking of it, there's something, and it's simply an analogy, but I think it's a good analogy to taste that, you bite into, let's say, a tangerine, or you take a sip of tea, or whatever the case may be, and there's a particular, like, inscape, as Hopkins used to say, each thing has its own inscape, and you sense that. And so I would say that among the books that I was listing as my favorites for the year, I would say that for me, each one of them has that quality of a certain vividness of it that is like a taste, and that they're quite different from one another. You know, the books are not just different in subject matter, but but they're different in their flavor as well. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you, we don't have too much time left, so I want to ask you about a couple of these. You've mentioned your book of the year, which was Atlas of the World by Craig Childs, and you've mentioned Patrick Modiano's Sleep of Memory, which you mentioned was published in France in 2017 and is now available in an English translation.
Right.
And you mentioned in your blurb or your little comments about it that you've read it three times already. What brought you back to it so many times?
Well, I mentioned when I was writing about it that a friend of mine who doesn't care for Modiano said all of his books are the same, you know. and I was conceding that in some ways, if not all, many of them are quite similar, but that if you like what he's doing, that's not a, a defect. And if you describe one of his books to someone, they might easily get a wrong impression. That they might, if you say, well, usually not a lot happens, and their mind would immediately go to a certain kind of fiction that often is described as avant-garde and that puts a special emphasis on, you might say, the linguistic reality, as opposed to pointing to the world and the words themselves. No words can, of course, be transparent, but Modiano isn't that kind of writer at all. It's nothing, the amount that actually happens in a clear way and in a novel by him compared to what happens in a, let's say, a typical novel is very small. And moreover, the books are very short, typically. And they're very elusive. A lot of them have to do with memory. And he's going back to different strata of time. He's recalling something that happened at a certain time, and then he jumps to something at another time. And it's often not exactly clear, even by the end of the book, precisely what happened. And as I say, if someone just heard a description like that, if someone just told me that and I had never read him, I might say, nah, probably not my cup of tea.
Sounds but, French.
I find his books, well, I think I used the word seductive, and it's very interesting. They are very short, sort of like reading one of the Maigret novels, you know, which I love. They're very short, and it's fascinating after you've read it once to go back and try to get a sense of how it's put together, and because you don't do that when you're reading it the first time. You're sort of caught up, and John Gardner had that wonderful phrase, a vivid, continuous dream. You know, you're sort of caught up in that when you're reading it the first time, and you experience that to some extent on a second reading, but at the same time, you have some sense of where you're going to end up, you know, and how you're going to get there, and you then can begin to think about, you might say, how it's made, how it's put together.
Okay. Well, I would love to talk to you about that book at length, but I have it on my, I actually put that on my Christmas wish list. So maybe I'll get that and we can actually do that.
Be sure to tell me what you think of it. I mean, if you don't like it, no blame, of course, but you know, I'd love to hear what you think of it.
Absolutely. I'd love to chat about it. I do want to ask you about a couple other books. If you have just a couple of minutes,
sure.
maybe on each of these. Okay. So many of my listeners are teachers. So I want to ask you about a book called The Teacher Diaries. It was with the subtitle.
Oh, I love that Teacher book. Diaries,
Romeo and Juliet. This is by Callie. Is that Fan? Callie Fane?
Yeah.
Tell Callie, me about that yeah. book, Callie.
Well, as I said, part of the reason I enjoyed it so much is that the news we hear from people who are teachers, both people we're personally acquainted with, but also what we read and articles and the paper and so on and so on, it tends to be very discouraging. And I know myself a lot of teachers at different levels. You know, some of them are elementary school, some of them are high school, some of them are college professors, some of them mainly teach in grad school. But I know a lot who are discouraged. And so it was just wonderful to read this short, very fresh book that takes Shakespeare and one of his plays that's been written about endlessly and adapted endlessly. You might say, but you know, somebody who's really, really sophisticated might sort of wave their hand and say, oh, you know, what can be said about this? But to feel the writer's zest for her students, because she talks about what works in the class and how her students respond to it. And so it would be wonderful to read, I think, for teachers. But also, it says interesting things about Shakespeare, and just in a very fresh way that's not overly encumbered. It's not that she hasn't read any scholarship, but it's not overly encumbered by scholarly argument. And it's the kind of book that you can read easily in an evening if you want to. And so I just found it delightful. She's doing a similar book on The Hobbit.
Oh, okay. I may have to get her on the podcast sometime.
You should. You should. We've never met in person, but we have corresponded a little bit, and she wrote one or two pieces for me. And she's, among other things, it sounds formidable, a literacy specialist, but she just loves, one thing that's very clear is that she loves teaching, and that comes through. It's kind of contagious in this book.
Hmm. I do feel like that's can be, you know, even if you love teaching, it's sort of a rare thing to actually make that a contagious thing in writing. It's not always easy to translate why you love it into your words in any other way than saying that I love it. But when you can do it and you can actually embody that, that's a rare thing. Let's talk about Alan Jacobs.
Yes.
You mentioned that he's a friend of yours. He has a new book out called The Year of Our Lord, 1943, Christian Humanism in an Age of Crisis. I always enjoy when Alan Jacobs releases a new book. So tell me about why this book made your list.
Well, it's a fascinating book, but it's also interesting to me because, as I said in my little comments about it when I put the list together, I would never have thought of combining the five writers he treats in the way that he does. And I even this frame, this, you know, Christian humanism and the sense that they had that something was happening in Western European civilization that was heading towards disaster, and that was embodied in a particular way in during World War II, but it was something that in their minds, and they were quite different figures, had a considerable history behind it, and how they had a kind of dream of, in different ways, very different ways, of trying to restore a Christian culture. And we would have to spend an hour talking about what that might mean. And it's not an idea that seems terribly plausible to me. And in fact, Alan concludes that even though they did wonderful work and went on to do more after the period that he's describing, that because of what he associates, it's a kind of shorthand, but technique or technology that it had become the dominant force in our society, and that was already an accomplished fact by the time that they were writing. So I don't know if I've done much to convey the the argument. There's a wonderful passage where he talks about W.H. Auden's poem, New Year Letter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see
we should clarify while you're looking that this is the five figures, the five subjects of the book are C.S. Lewis, Auden, Vail, Eliot, and who's the
Jacques Maritain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And if anyone has the book or is considering it and browsing, and if you read, starts on page 65 and it goes to page 68, and he's talking about Auden's great poem written in 1940 called New Year Letter. And he quotes from it, "More even than in Europe, here the choice of patterns," here being America, where Auden had come from England, "more even than in Europe, here the choice of patterns is made clear, which the machine imposes, what is possible and what is not, to what conditions we must bow in building the just city now." And then just after that, Alan quotes another passage from the same poem, "that the machine has now destroyed the local customs we enjoyed, replaced bonds of blood and nation by personal confederation to judge our means and plan our ends." So that is, of course, there's a lot more to the book, but in a nutshell, that gives much of the argument of the book.
Okay, a couple more. A.E. Stallings, Like, a book of poetry.
Yes.
Stallings, if I'm not mistaken, is also known as a classicist, is she not?
Yes, and she's done some translations from the classics, yes.
Does that show up in her poetry, do you think? I mean, do you sense, is that part of the flavor of this book, so to speak?
Well, it shows up in various ways. It shows up partly because being saturated in that literature has permanently shaped her imagination, and of course there will be references now and then to direct references, but I also think that because she has been engaged in translating and in the very, very difficult effort to find the right word to take a poem from the ancient world and try to make it readable in English in the here and now, I think that something of the spareness of her poetry, her books tend to be relatively short, and I think that probably isn't unrelated to her experience as a translator and her long acquaintance with these texts, which of course are the ones that have survived. There were a lot more that have been lost along the centuries, and so this winnowing has taken place, and I think that has affected the way that she writes herself as a poet.
Okay. Every time you start talking about these books, I have all kinds of questions, but this is not the podcast for that kind of conversation.
I apologize for such truncated. We were talking earlier about getting the flavor, and you know, you can open this new book of hers almost any place in the book and read a couple of poems and you'll know whether you want to read more. So the firsthand experience with the text is is far superior, but I think she's a exceptionally interesting poet, and a new book by her is always for me an event.
I'm pretty sure that this last person I'm going to ask you about is also an event when he comes out with a book every 6 weeks, as he does. And that is Michael Connelly, who released Dark Sacred Night. And obviously it's not true that he comes out with a book every 6 weeks, but he has written quite a few novels about the detective Harry Bosch. There's also an HBO series, right? Or no.
No, it's an Amazon series, and it's excellent. It's Wendy and I have enjoyed it, and it helps a lot that Connelly himself has been involved in making the series. So
Well, I think among people who love crime fiction and spy novels and all that sort of thing, there is sometimes at least among some people, the sense that the golden age of those sorts of books has sort of passed us by, and that a lot of the stuff we get now is just kind of is lesser than, so to speak. But you're quite a champion for Connolly, and you know, you've recommended several of his books to me, and I picked up a few of them and enjoyed them. And so I'm curious, what is it about Connolly in particular that you think is worth reading and makes him a worthy sort of successor to some of the golden age of crime fiction writers?
Well,
so to speak.
One thing about Connolly is that he tells a wonderful story of going away to college in Florida and preparing to be an engineer. His father was a builder, and he worked a little bit in the summers with his father's work. And the idea was that Connolly would get a engineering background, and then he would be able to work with his dad. He went to college, and he found that he just didn't, that wasn't what he really wanted to do the most. He wanted to write. And he specifically wanted to write crime fiction, and he came and told his parents that, and his father did not just throw up his arms and say, "Oh, you know, what an idiotic idea that is." He said, "You're going to need something to fall back on, so you should plan on that." And so Connolly decided to become a journalist, and he graduated from college and got a job in Florida as a newspaper reporter. And of course, the newspaper business was a lot different then, and flourishing, actually. And he eventually came and worked for the LA Times. And so he put in some years as a journalist, and he worked on the crime beat for quite a while. And he learned the nuts and bolts of crime in a way that someone whose experience of it is strictly literary doesn't have. And at the same time, he was, right from the beginning, starting from when he was still quite, you know, a young man, he loved reading Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and some of the other great
the classics.
Yeah. And so he combines, on the one hand, a passion for and a knowledge of that tradition, and on the other hand, this nuts and bolts knowledge, including cultivating relationships with cops over the years, who he often will acknowledge in his books. So as a writer, you know, sentence by sentence, and he, I'm sure, would be well aware of this himself, but he's not a crafter of sentences the way that, let's say, Chandler or Ross McDonald were. Mm-hmm. But his writing is always grounded in reality, which you can't say of some crime fiction. And there's a deep moral grounding as well. So that I would say that's another one of his most appealing qualities as a novelist. And he's also just a really hard worker. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. He hasn't rested on his laurels. You know, he keeps pushing himself, and there's a burning ambition there too that hasn't become extinguished yet. So all those together have made him a really good writer. But I mean, for people who are interested in trying crime fiction, I don't think there's ever been a better time for crime. I mean, there are tons of younger writers, and Connolly would be now, you know, it seems like not that long ago he was breaking in. Now he's part of the old guard, you know. So
where would you
Go ahead.
Where would you suggest people, should people just jump in with Dark Sacred Night or maybe The Late Show? Or would you suggest they go back and start with The Black Echo, which is that's the first Bosch book, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
What I would say is read Dark Sacred Night, and which I think is terrific. And if you really like it, then yes, go back to the first book. And because the way that the characters evolve over time, preeminently Harry Bosch, but others as well, is part of what makes the book so satisfying. And you really can't get that if you just hop around and, you know, read a book from the middle and then read another real recent one. But you know, to each his own. And what I would urge is do exactly as you said, read this newest one. And if you say, oh, it was okay, but I don't think I want to go back and read 25 or 30 more, that's fine. But if you really like it, then go back to the beginning.
Well, I'd love to talk to you about the two books about Vikings that you mentioned, but we'll just tell people that they should look at the list to look at those. So here's my last question for you, since I know you got to go.
Okay.
Is there a book that you believe, a book from your list that should have received more attention than it got, that you wish that you would like to champion and hope that way more people will read than it seems like have already done so?
I think I'd mentioned the novel Heads of the Colored People, which not a novel, a collection of stories, which it has not been. I mentioned it hasn't been totally ignored. I've seen a couple good reviews of it. The Chicago Tribune, since she teaches in Chicago, did a nice profile of her. So it's not like it's been completely ignored, but on the other hand, I haven't seen near as much coverage of it as I've seen by a number of other books that in my mind are not as that don't stand out as much. Of course, that's partly a matter of taste, but it is very unusual in that it's satiric and also very humane at the same time. And you don't often find that combination, and maybe that's part of the why it hasn't been covered quite as much as it, because it's not, there's a biting, there's some biting satire in it. But at the same time, I wouldn't describe it as an angry book at all. I would say it's very perceptive, very fresh. I think I mentioned in my little entry for it that the author describes herself as a black nerd, and she has a wonderful sense of humor, and again, as I say, just a humane quality that goes with this this satiric wit.
So this is by, I'm just trying to make sure I have it right. Nafissa Thompson Spires, is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And for all our listeners, I'll make sure that I post these books and some links to them in the show notes for this. And then I hope people will go look up your favorite books of 2018, the full article over at First Things. And then also you have a coming attractions list for 2019 over at First Things, which you posted back in November. We don't have time to talk about that now. But there are some books, there's more crime fiction referenced in there, and a book about Edward Lear and a number of other things. So if people are interested in that, they should head over to First Things and check that out. I kept you a little bit longer than I promised, so I apologize for that. But thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it was a very enjoyable conversation, David. And don't worry about the time. I probably could have been much more concise in some of my answers, but talking about books is a pleasure, and so thank you for the chance.
Of course, thank you, and thank you for being here. And again, I hope people will go check out all your lists and buy at least one copy of every book and try them all out.
Well, I don't know about that, but if a reader finds even one book that just sounds like his or her cup of tea, I will be delighted.
That was John Wilson from the Englewood Review of Books and First Things. Thanks to John for joining me. Don't forget to be on the lookout for his work in the Englewood Review of Books at englewoodreview.com and at firstthings.com. Each of the books he mentioned are listed in the show notes, so be sure to check those out and support the authors he talked about. For John's complete Best of 2018 list, head over to firstthings.com. The link is in the description of this episode. And thanks to you for listening. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review this show. I'll be back next week with another conversation. Thanks for listening and happy reading.